Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Royal Academy of Arts. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Edmund Duval and David Hills of DSDH Architects. Tonight is the third and the final event in a series we've been running over the last few weeks now on artist studios. Studios provide an incredibly interesting kind of lens into thinking about architecture. We hope by having a platform between architect and artist to really open up some of the conversations that have taken place. And the studio itself, I think, is a very interesting one. It has to negotiate incredible numbers of practical things, particularly in the case of Edmund's studio. But it's also a space that has to kind of enhance creativity, or is one in which creative practice takes place. There becomes a relationship between the physical space and perhaps the mental space of which one engages in it. I think this series has been asking a number of times, actually, you know, what is the space of a studio for an artist? And we started this a number of weeks ago with Anselm Kiefer talking about his own studio, principally his one in Barjac, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with, but it is an incredible kind of landscape that he has shaped. It's a sort of Gesamtkunstwerk. It is not just his studio, but a sort of an artwork in its own right, where he's sculpted and created tunnels, he's created giant amphitheatres, he's created pavilions in which he houses his work. And he said, when he was asked about this studio, what he felt about it, and he said, it's kind of, it's a reflection of his mind. And so, in fact, it is his mind. So I think what's interesting in his way is that he makes a space that is a reflection of his mind in which he works. And if you go into the galleries in the Royal Academy, they're sort of quadruple or probably times that by 100 times, and you have a sense of what he's working in. And then we had a second discussion with Alan Jones, talking about his studio designed by Piers Gough. And Alan said actually he creates a space, or he wants a space where he entirely gets lost. And he says he goes into his space, the studio in Oxfordshire, and he'll work continually for 8 hours there and will come out and not quite know where he is, sort of be surprised to find the Oxford landscape out in front of him. And I think this evening we have quite a different studio, because for Edmund it's a space where he makes, he writes, and also a sort of space where the work comes into a semi-exhibition and its sort of agency changes within that. But we do want to interrogate this relationship between an architect and an artist, and that sort of shared understanding of practice, the sort of dynamic of conversation that's taken place. So it's not just about the studio tonight. I think it hopefully is opening up other dialogues about architecture. And I'm pleased that tonight is the final one in these series, because I think it will probably be the richest of all of these conversations, because it has been a long-standing relationship between Edmund and David and many conversations which have taken place, which are not just about the studio, but a number of works they've made together and also collaborated on. So it hasn't just been a relationship between architect and client. They have been sort of working alongside one another with their practice. I think it is very special, the nature of those involved. They're both incredibly thoughtful, broad interests and a curiosity in people, things and places. David set up his practice in 1998 with his partner Deborah Saunt, and this practice, DSDH, has, I think, defined some really interesting architecture. They've led incredibly high on ideas of collaboration, but also on research. And that's looking at the urban realm with an interest in people in the city and really thinking about what makes a place, the physical and social history and materiality. And they don't just give it lip service, this research. This research kind of echoes down into all of their work that you see. And some really exceptional projects, not just like these small discrete studios, but also very big and complex things like education projects. They were Stirling Prize nominated for Christ College, Guildford. And I think there's some lovely other projects that are dotted about the city. A couple of favourites of mine are the little pavilion down behind City Hall, the charred timber pavilion, if you know it. It kind of really, it's tiny and modest, but very powerful against the sort of big City Hall, Foster's big City Hall egg sort of fallen over, leaning towards it. And then the project on South Moulton Street, if you know it, which has glazed ceramic tiles on that sort of corner of South Moulton Street near Bond Street Tube where you come out. Also Alex Munro's studio down in Borough. So they have done these sorts of studios, and their practice ranges across from these very big ones to the small. And in all of those, they show great care. And I think, you know, you see the correlation with Edmund's work here. You can see why the interest has fallen between the two of them. He's an artist who's interested in objects, in collections, in place, in histories. And that's echoed in his work, but also beautifully illustrated in his book that he wrote in 2010, Hair with Amber Eyes, which I'm sure many of you have read. And if you haven't, I encourage you to do so. It's a wonderful family memoir that traces the story of Netsuke. I think what's interesting about Edmund is he is the sort of work relationship between his work as a ceramicist and writing. And I think this will probably come up when we start to talk about the studio, of how these two spaces for different sorts of creative work start to interplay. And Edmund is obviously an incredibly well-known ceramist artist. He came to love, if I'm putting words in his mouth, but, you know, found a love for the pot at a very early age. At sort of five, he threw his first pot, and then studied while still a student with Geoffrey Whiting, who was a disciple of Bernard Leach. Then went on deferring his place at Cambridge to actually go and spend time in Japan looking at ceramics there, and had an apprenticeship with Whiting where he made pots, I think, kind of continually, which he still does. I mean, we had a talk a couple of days ago and someone said, but someone else must make Edmund's pots, don't they? No, they don't. And I think that, you know, this sort of space for not just for just making and relentless making is a really interesting thing. But tonight's conversation is hopefully going to be quite loose. We met a few weeks ago and then started a conversation, then deliberately thought we don't want to rehearse it, so stop talking. And so it's going to be sort of divided into three sections. The beginning bit, I'm just going to ask Edmund and David a few things, and hopefully we can spark and bring to life some of this conversation, which I think takes place as their friendship develops, as they work, and the two intertwine. We're then going to talk more specifically about these studio spaces, and they're going to talk us through. And then we'll return to have quite a lot of time for discussion, and I hope, you know, we'll invite you to join in. And so while we do talk, there's going to be sort of, we've got slides on a loop here, which are showing principally Edmund's works moving through his various installations, and then you'll start to see the studio spaces emerge behind us. Then we will talk in more detail about the studio. So they're not meant to be there as things that we talk directly to, but they're just giving you a feel, a flavour, a reminder of the work as the conversations begin. So I might just start with a really most basic question, but even describing, you know, how you met, how you came to find one another.
It's about common friends, in fact, isn't it?
It was absolutely common friends. So there was joint friendships from way back. And then I knew what you were up to. I mean, I was keeping an eye on you.
There was a sort of an...
But there was a reason why you got back in touch.
There was an awful accident, which in the days when Edmund made pots to use, Deborah Saun had been given some a collection of coffee cups, in fact, that Edmund had made, and I had the unfortunate accident of smashing them all. And
it's such a cool way of getting back in touch with someone.
So, but their conversations, well, that's what they're for. They're supposed to be broken. In those days, you were supposed to break them. No longer. But so I was in the great fortunate position of being able to recommission a set of coffee cups to replace those at the time when Edmund was looking at making his own studio.
You see, I remember it differently, which is, in the old days, I used to make these espresso cups, which were really nice, weren't they? You used to like them. I mean, they were really small and kind of, you know, they were delicate. And they had these, I used the end of a paintbrush to make these little marks on them. They were very nice things. And you broke them and rang up. And you said, would you make some more cups? And I think I said no, because I didn't make espresso cups.
You did say you don't make them anymore.
Yeah. But at that moment, I was working in a shared studio, a beautiful shared studio in a warehouse in Peckham. And I just bought a site in another bit of South London and was looking for an architect. That's my memory.
So it was on that condition that I worked on it.
Well, no, that we began... I mean, there was this extraordinary beginning of a thing, which was that which is, I hadn't seen you for a while, and then suddenly there was this thing about you, we were sitting around this table in a studio, and I was very alive to the idea of what happened next, because I didn't want to share the studio, I wanted to move on, I wanted to be elsewhere. And there you were, and we started to talk about studios.
The first studio, yeah. That's very true. That was in itself an amazing opportunity, because our practice was also in South London. We had lots of kind of shared connections, I think, that had emerged through a number of years. And so the opportunity to go and start looking, extending a conversation about making something together was really exciting.
And one of the interesting things about where you were as a practice was it was in that extraordinary muse, wasn't it, down in Elephant, where there was a sort of jumble of different kinds of practice. So you weren't sort of, you know, in a beautiful kind of tower block being architects and sort of posh. You were, I mean, you might get there, but you weren't there, but you were amongst other kinds of practice. So there were, you know, jewellers and potters and carpenters and, and so was I. I was, you know, I at that point wasn't posh either. And I was amongst all kinds of other things as well. So there was that feeling of texture about work. It was, which I think was very kind of shared, that sense of what...
I think both of us were informed a lot by the context of which our projects, where we worked, that it wasn't a kind of hermetically sealed environment. And I remember one of the first things that you'd said about it would be easy to speak to an architect about a studio and it quickly goes to the direction of a gallery and a sort of space for displaying. But this was very much about an engagement with a space for making that would be enriched by knowing that other things had happened before.
Which was that interesting, because when I first went to your studio down in Elephant and Castle, you went down this cobbled mews, past all these different people with their doors open, doing all kinds of things. I mean, really interesting, you know, real South London work. You know, all kinds of things going on. And then up these stairs, and it was very interesting because, you know, you were doing all kinds of projects, different kinds of scale and different kinds of texture, different kinds of materiality. But you were in a building which had an extraordinary presence of a previous life. It was a sort of palimpsest in itself. And I so liked the fact that it wasn't banks of Macs going down into the distance.
Yeah, we had a very messy studio. We can't even talk about some of the things that had happened in the studio before we went there, really... They were rather unpleasant, some of them.
It's that idea of a practice emerging out of serial kinds of work, rather than it being a kind of sort of monologue. That completely got that.
The fascination of the sort of multiple and not knowing what we were going to achieve is, I think, when in our studio there hopefully are kind of rows and rows of tests of a project that explores a whole series of narratives and issues through which a kind of story emerges of what the final project may be. And it's definitely sort of shared interest that you start in one direction and don't quite know where you're going, another influence comes along, and this sort of inflections.
Yeah, you see, the reason I knew we'd get on is when we sat down and had coffee and used the word iteration, which is possibly my favourite word, you see. And I didn't know at that moment that all architects use that word all the time. I thought that was so cool, you know, so cool. I was really, really excited by the fact of sitting next to an architect who was using the word iteration. Being a potter, that's all I do, is to iterate and reiterate. I make one thing and then I make another and another, and I come back and I test and retest and refire. So it's a whole series of testings going on. And so the idea that the emergence of buildings out of ideas might be a series of sort of holding up of tests and looking at them and then putting them down and moving on to another one seemed to me a really kind of credible way of making buildings, rather than just sort of sketching something and sort of printing it.
Shared interest in part in process, is that right? That was where you sort of connected at one level.
I think the process, but also one of the things that really interested me was about the sort of placement of Edmund's work within a specific site and place to provoke a different understanding or relationship. The project in MIMA was relocated in two galleries, which was completely different readings.
Yeah.
And that actually provoked another conversation about a shared project which grew out of a few years later, actually.
That was a really interesting moment because there was this invitation for me to work in Kettle's Yard, which was a shared place because we'd all been at Cambridge together. And Kettle's Yard is kind of ground zero for a lot of English people in terms of sort of modernity and domesticity and how you can make spaces work. So that was kind of very shared thing. But the idea was I made work for there, and then it went to MIMA in Middlesbrough, which is a very, very tricky and unsuccessful, I have to say, building. And but that idea of iteration, again, of how you put work down in one place and then it changes its identity, which of course is immediately about storytelling, you know, completely about narrative. And the idea that actually, you know, that's possible within architecture. You can tell stories, yeah. Plural.
The idea for me, anyway, about that architecture has a duration to it, that you... The longer you spend in a space or a setting, the more hopefully you can get out of it, that it's not just about seeing something once and in an immediate way. And that placement of work was really about opening up a more thorough engagement with place. And all the Castells was very specific,
yes,
about that, but actually all of your work has that same very considered and emotional connection with place.
But it was also, I mean, it was also the thing about, you know, where does work happen? Now, you know, if you're a potter, you're in the old days, the sort of leech tradition, it was very codified about where your pots should be, you know, in the kitchen, ideally, or at ground, not at Wadston, for instance, but that idea that actually there were particular locations where pots had meaning, and other things were off limits. Whereas what I was trying to do was to try to find out what they could mean in lots and lots of different places, which of course meant that my work was in dialogue with buildings, and of course I'd always wanted to be an architect. Didn't have the guts to become one, I just became a potter. So, you know, the idea of actually being able to sort of begin to talk about how do you frame objects within the frame of buildings became very, very kind of crucial.
Has your thinking about architecture changed in doing that and through this process of working together? Because I think, are you looking at architecture differently as you start to place architecture? You know, your work starts to test architecture, I think. It starts to open up dialogues that one can't see, and I'm wondering if there's an evolving... Are you starting to look at architecture differently through this process?
One of the projects which was really interesting for... I mean, you may already have been ahead of this, but when we started working on a project which Deborah was leading for in Soho, which was fascinating for us to try and engage with this idea of public art and how you could embed working with an artist in a different way on a project. And so the opportunity, we were already looking at glazed terracotta and ceramic facades. So the idea or opportunity to work with Edmund on a scale where you could really affect the surface of a building was a really interesting sort of moment for us.
Well, it was fascinating because this was a conversation. It was a very interesting and tricky site. I mean, that was a really interesting project. It was actually a very nice Edwardian building that you were going to get rid of, wasn't it?
It was a very nice building, but it could be better.
It could be better.
It was a locally listed police station, which was also, although it was quite fine, had a very poor relationship to the street in terms of a very dense part of the city, so that the narratives of where you would walk through views, vistas and connections with the site were... relatively poor, and I think that's where our engagement with the site came about. We're taking a journey into the building in its context,
and you have to imagine a kind of, you know, it was Soho, so it was to, the streets were kind of tunnels, weren't they? And so the idea was, how can you bring light into those spaces and make something which actually was sort of almost self-illuminated, actually produce light and shadow in a space, which of course is what pots do. And the most deadly words in the English language are public art. They are just so completely horrific. It's sort of public art is a sort of post hoc kind of embarrassed thing where you go, you've screwed up some site, and then you get an artist in to kind of do an apologetic thing. It's a kind of sop.
We got you to do some of our architecture and called it.
So the idea of actually of being involved not in doing something after the building and planning had happened, not post hoc art, but actually being involved right from the beginning in thinking about what might happen in the building. And this was this idea of embedding something, which of course, and that's also kind of actually, and the idea was, it was a really beautiful idea.
Yeah, and I think it picked up sort of themes that were resonant in Edmund's work about, you know, even horizons and vistas within, for us, the city, but mm-hmm. it meant that there was kind of a tactile engagement, there was an interest in the untouchable, the kind of glistening character which you might capture from a more distant field frame. So I think it began to sort of break down this sort of some elements of finding work within the city, but actually and then touching it at the same different instances.
We were going to have embedded, really embedded in the wall, like a sort of geological strata. These beautiful long lines of handmade porcelain right the way around the building in at different levels. It was just that idea of a sort of, you know, of a child walking down a street, you know, sort of, and being able to run your hands all the way around the building, along a piece of porcelain all the way around the building, which was really beautiful. And then having something just adult height, and then something which was sort of aspirationally high, and then something which was impossibly high. And that idea of sort of giving tactility, you know, back into buildings, which was yeah. already so kind of much part of your language of how you were doing, but you'd just done. I mean, you've done that.
The shift now is that, you know, those conversations you were just telling me that yeah. there's a slim chance this building might happen again, but Edmund's already programmed now to 2019 or something. So the idea of resurrecting it might have to be reinvented in a different way.
Luckily, we're not on tape. No one is taping this conversation. I mean, but I love that idea. The scary thing about sort of, you know, being an artist and working with architects is about where are you allowed to work. This is actually quite a good example. You know, where are you allowed to work? You know, what's your zone? Where do you belong? And so the openness of this thing about actually everything's possible. You can be below, you can be above, you can be in the building. You can walk through the building and actually discover at different points. Seemed to me just really, really exciting.
Yeah, it's quite refreshing for to work alongside that freshness in terms of questioning a brief as an architect as well, that if you're asked to design something, can you move outside of what you're asked to do and actually pursue a more interesting conversation about it?
That might be a good segue into the discussion about the studio. Was there a brief? Did you develop one together? Was there a conversation about the sort of space you wanted? Was it one about practical things, or was it about the space you wanted to be in?
So we remember this differently as well.
It's like an old married couple on stage. Actually, have we got the slides of the studios, or will they emerge out of?
They will go, yeah, we can. Yeah, let's go to the other one.
Yeah, because actually, it was. We'll lose.
We're coming back to these later.
Lose Chipperfield. It was a very complicated site. I think the brief began by it was a very, very complicated site. It was a very, very complicated. It's basically a garage in Tulse Hill. I mean, how glamorous is that?
So what year is this? This is
11 years ago.
It's about 2004, this first studio.
Yeah.
With similarly an amazing eclectic group of people occupying yeah. these yards, it was a very, very similar to Islip Yard where we were.
Eclectic is the politest possible way you could define the demographic of my neighbours.
Billy Ocean had his recording studio on one side, and there was a lot of Caribbean car workshops.
And that's just the beginning. I mean, it was fantastic. Actually, it was really fantastic when you had kind of posh Notting Hill types coming down to try and buy porcelain, and then having to kind of navigate Tremendously pleasing, actually, as their anxiety levels rose higher and higher.
There was an amazing one of the openings that you had at the studio where you were safely inside, but when you left, all of the chauffeurs were waiting at the end of the yard because they were too scared to drive in. And there was this sort of fearsome moment where they'd let people out of their cars, not knowing whether they'd actually get back, I think. So the space was brilliant because it had been a leather upholsterer's for vintage cars.
Yeah.
So it was a really dark space. This is the kind of yard space. It was just like a covered yard with a small two story building to the right, and it was incredibly dark. And I suppose the conversation was about how can we bring light into this environment to make a space for working, but would also open up the other uses that were needed.
Yeah, so, you know, I was massively aspirational. This was my chance to have an architect take me seriously, so I had huge expectations. And what I wanted was a space. I mean, the thing about making pots is that it's a whole series of basically dreadfully messy tasks. You know, you've got clay, wet clay, which produces dust. You've got glazing, which produces just crap everywhere. You've got kilns, which produce fumes. And then you've got to grind things down and packing. You've got all these sort of processes, all of which are just sort of industrial processes. And I wanted something which was, you know, as beautiful as the Barcelona Pavilion. I wanted a space in which to work and have a library. I wanted a space in which I could try out work. That was absolutely part of it. Sort of just look at things and put installations together. I wanted it to be everything to be able to be moved out so that I could have other people's work, show other people's work. I think I wanted everything, really.
It was a very interesting time, but it was a very generous brief because you had assistants at the time, so it was already a conversation with Edmund, but also about how other people used the space as well. So that it was, you had assistants who would really be making their own work and would be exhibited together. So at times there were shared exhibitions going to be in the space, but as well as all of the kind of processes of making. The interesting thing was the first thing I think you said was that it had to have somebody somewhere to sit down, have a cup of coffee. The kitchen was also a really important part of this because straight away, again, I think the idea of the conversation of welcoming people into the studio, interesting conversations, formed the starting point probably for many projects.
Well, it was the sort of lots of people come to the studio, and it was so actually that whole sort of threshold thing was completely critical. It's interesting because actually you came up with this idea of everything being movable except for these two enormously heavy black objects in the space. So it was going to be a white space with two things. And if we go back to the beginning, like the Malevich's black square, you came in. And there was Malevich in front of you, this sort of zero of kind of moment, and they were beautiful black concrete. So there were these two objects, and everything else could be moved. I have to say, more pots were broken on your expensive black concrete.
It really
concrete.
I can
thing
tell you, nothing, the washing in, that, up was nothing in that studio was expensive.
No.
They were. It's very nice of you to say beautiful black. Concrete objects, because they were really handmade. I mean, this whole studio was made with the collaborators who were already making early vitrines and cabinetry. Yeah. So it was really a
the budget was nothing.
It was a very fast project, and it was just testing this series of ideas. As Edmund said, the rawness of the walls was something we enjoyed, keeping the texture of the building so that the it can be very flexible in terms of displaying work that was being made at the time, although as we will go on, that obviously reached a kind of a critical point of scale. But alongside this one key space was opening up the connections to the what was to be the kind of library and writing space above, and then the kiln room on the lower floor. So just stripping back the existing building so that, again, Edmund's work was housed or found within areas as you just transitioned from one space to the other. And as you moved up to the top of the studio, there were just really simple moves about bringing in more light using the same material, so that I think the work could, or the work that you were making at the time, could just breathe in this sort of changing, very soft.
This was a lovely space up. It was it was a very, very beautiful space. The light was very kind of diffuse, and it was pots and...
Yeah, so I think that was the transition, that this amazing library that Edmund has was part of the brief for this space, so that on the one hand it's shown earlier on in the photographs as a place of display, but the reality of it was this is a space of thinking, I think, more than anything else.
I wrote proper books up there.
And so the presentation of that project in those images all looks very calm, and this was one of my favourite images.
Well, this is Hélène Binet.
She calms everything down.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's Edmund at work in this incredibly calm space in quite a messy environment, but this very sort of thoughtful process. And I suppose a few years later, the reality was when you go through the studio, it was just extraordinarily compressed with the amount of work and testing that was being, you'd already spread into a shed, hadn't you, as well?
Yeah, I was taking over Tulse Hill. I mean, there was a sort of acceleration of how work was happening, and this very beautiful laboratory for work that you'd created, which was extraordinarily successful. Had changed into being, if you keep going, into being, down. There were more people upstairs working. I couldn't write anymore in my writing room because
To mention that downstairs the kiln room was also basically when the kiln room was in operation, you couldn't use the upstairs room because of
the fumes
or heat. So the doors had to be open permanently in order to ventilate the space. So it was a really challenging environment at a time when massive commissions were happening, weren't they? So the sort of pressures and deadlines were.
There was a particular moment when it was really, it was just too much, which is I'd been taken on by this rather grand American gallery. And they were coming down to look at work, and we were firing a kiln, and we were all, the people couldn't go into the building because the kiln was firing, and it was all full of stuff, and it wasn't any longer a place that I wanted to go and work in. It's not your fault.
No, but it was then a very sort of sudden. Or very fast pressure. Where we were asked recently, somebody asked about what's your relationship as a client and architect, and Edmund said we don't have a client architect relationship, but at the same time, when you're told I have a show opening in New York in 8 months' time, and I need to find somewhere to move to, and I want you to make the new space, and you're thinking, hey, this is a really fast turnaround.
Is it?
The reality is, so in October 2012, I think, sometime around then anyway, Edmund found this amazing new studio just up the road in Norwood, next to a bus depot, where the ambition from October 2012 was to then leave Tulse Hill one day and carry on making pots in Norwood.
Which I thought was fine.
With a six-month time
I'm
scale.
Sounding like, I'm sounding like an utter diva. Absolute.
I think actually...
I thought it was fine that you'd actually... I'd be able to stop throwing one day and start throwing up the road.
A few months later.
Yeah.
So the next studio was an amazing opportunity because you found the space, which was about 6,000 square feet. It was vast compared to... previous studio, and it had this amazing history in itself of being a munitions factory, or workshop, which in itself is kind of an extraordinary thing to have next to this bus depot in a way.
It was incredibly beautiful and melancholic. It was a kind of sabled kind of set, if you can see what I mean. It was full of boxes saying explosives, and extraordinary bits of equipment. And it was an old firm that had finally gone into the ground, and it just seemed too good a chance to not go for it.
So, and weirdly, it's quite a similar arrangement. One large space, and next to it, a sort of two-storey office, series of office spaces, which were really claustrophobic, but also a little bit like a set from Mad Men, which was quite charming, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
And so the conversation there was, I guess, about how, it was about taking pretty much the same components of writing now on a bigger scale, making on a bigger scale, and the kitchen on a bigger scale, receiving guests and work just on a vastly sort of different operation, but keeping alive the same narratives probably. And also I think the challenge for us was about how you took such a vast space and also maintained a connection with the kind of domestic scale or the setting for, you know, almost holding a pot as an individual.
Yeah, I was very clear that I didn't want to end up with a space which was so beautiful that I couldn't make pots in it, and that actually, when I sort of envisioned making or writing, there had to be intimacy in those things. The rest of the spaces could be extraordinary and expansive and lucid and, you know, and have and be scaled. But that there had to be that kind of, and that I couldn't work out how you were going to do it. So it was a very interesting.
So we inevitably worked with a series of models and sketches, which were really about testing the scale of that space and the role of the table. I think was really interesting at the conversation, because you had this idea that where the kitchen, which was the place of kind of conversation, was now also about where work was viewed, where it was. Packed, unpacked, unfolded. Everything about the work would happen through this series of tables, which could march through the space, but also offer this flexibility. And how we would, within the volume of that space, find places to work, where you wouldn't be lost as an individual, and where you could it could kind of break down into narratives about places, you know, for working in a kind of way that you were connected but not separated.
Can we go back to one? One photo. Is this you putting up work in Edmund's studio?
This is us looking at how you could locate a kind of library of books and drawing it probably as one of your installations.
Well, anything in a line looks like one of my installations. So it's a bit kind of.
Well,
it's a bit kind of.
I think it was maybe implicitly it's the kind of the memory for me of Kettle's Yard of. Finding the book spine reinterpreted as a.
Oh, yes.
It's a pretty interesting echo between the two.
But the volume of the space in this section here shows the kind of the this is a pointer, the kind of volume of the kind of main shed, and then at the side, this is what we did to it in the end, that we opened up the space a little bit, which we'll show you, but it was about how you could connect this, you know, previously separated office building to the kind of main workshop space. And in terms of the kind of how it ended up, this shows the kind of the main volume of the space, which was divided with a wall through it, and then a series of openings which were made along the kind of smaller spaces at the side to sort of unfold all of the narratives of making.
And this was fascinating because, you know, I couldn't see how this building would work. I mean, I knew it was big. In fact, actually, the next slide, you know.
This sort of demonstrates that
so
shift.
So that's the old studio onto the new studio. So I knew it was bigger, which I liked. But I couldn't understand how the connectivity of all this stuff would work. I really wanted it not to be a series of sort of hermetic spaces. That really, really mattered to me because, I you know, they are... Those bits of my life are really, really profoundly connected. So I didn't want to be sort of that. And your what you did was really very interesting.
I think that conversation briefing was really interesting for me because I am really fascinated about how artists work within their space as an individual or a team and how that works. And so the studio team, who might be more perceived to be more administrative, in some ways, or there was the notion of office, this dreaded word of office, and it would have been very easy to place the kind of the default would have been easy to put the office in the kind of what was the office building, and there was a lot of conversation about how disconnected that would be from the processes involved of making the placing and researching the work. So there was an absolute ambition to open up the existing building to create two moments of connection, both on arrival within the building and then latterly as you go through the journey to reconnect where the area for writing and thinking with the main studio. And this shows the sort of sequence within this very generous programme that was given to us over Christmas, of taking apart what was a really kind of dense entrance hall to open up a vertical connection which, you know, it was kind of messy but worthwhile, because the result was that coming into the studio is opened up into a double height space where it's flooded with light.
Yeah.
You immediately feel that you need to look in many directions.
The other word you used on our first meeting was liminal, which is, again, you know, a love affair with liminality. You know, anything to do with thresholds is important. I mean, but the idea of actually, you know, really investing in that space of how you come in, really, really thinking it through, so that when you come into a building, not everything is shown to you. You know, it is absolutely the genkan, the kind of Japanese place where you put something down and change gear. So it's not, you know, it's not like an English country house where, you know, it's all kind of like that. So some things are withheld. But what you do get is absolutely the texture of the building. So you've got all the materiality there in absolutely on the threshold. And you've got the kind of invitation to go up or go through. It works. I mean, it really, really works. But, you know, again, it works more and more and more. Actually, have we got... Can you see... Yeah.
So at the time, I think you were just working on a piece actually in Cambridge, weren't you? Where Edmund's work was buried beneath the pavements, and so this was another dimension that was Edmund was really keen to sort of build into that sequence of coming through the building. You discover work, and it's an opportunity to test that condition.
I love the idea of being of walking into a building across a vitrine, you know, actually having to walk over porcelain to get into the building. It seems to me beautifully perverse.
I don't know how we are for time, but just running through this. The texture of the building was something you also really, really wanted to not radically erase the kind of history of this building. And so we worked quite hard to sort of find a place to locate the kind of kitchen buried within this kind of lower wall and zone, again by just removing part of the wall, but actually using the same material, white painted brick, to kind of shield the kitchen. So it wasn't thrown into your face, but it was just offered then to this flexible environment. And then looking at a series of where we did have to warm the building up, because it was pretty freezing.
It's absolutely freezing.
On Saturday, we went into the kiln room, and the kiln room does, your brief, didn't have underfloor heating because of the kilns heating up, and it's the one area where it's absolutely freezing, isn't it? It was amazing to know that
that was what the space was
the
like.
The space was unbearable.
Glacial. Yes.
But so part of the brief was then lining some of the walls so that they did take on a condition which was able to be interpreted or used as gallery settings, because the work is now placed in so many different environments. So the sort of formality of the space was kind of bought, but only offered into the existing shell of the building, we hope. And you see on the right-hand side of that image just the slot that was just left so that you could retain the kind of long vistas through the space, again providing another way of reading scale within the building. And then as you move behind that that wall, the mezzanine. We built a mezzanine because of archiving, which was, I mean, I don't believe you can, it can provide all the archiving that's needed.
No.
Now, but there's more archiving than was available before. And then moving into a more intimate setting, which is where the glazing starts happening. But they're visually connected. I think the idea was to sort of allow breathing space for.
If you think about studio as conversation, you know, you want people to be in conversation with each other. You want them to be able to have spaces which are clear enough for them to be to work with. For people who are working on glazing or firing or packing or working in the sort of hub of the office itself, to be able to work with concentration and not be sort of endlessly sort of jangled by lots of other things. But absolutely, you want people to be aware of what's going on so they're not atomized processes, because if they're atomized, then you don't get the coherence. And so the studio is a series. It's absolutely this sort of chain of interconnected spaces, you know, acoustically as well as, you know, which can be a little challenging sometimes, but acoustically as well as sort of spatially, as you know, in terms of the volume. But we're going up.
So moving through the studio, you go from a kind of quite grand now, actually, entrance hall, but that just offers these distant views, and then through a compressed space towards the main studio, and then you come move through to these workspaces up a little discreet staircase into the mezzanine, which is at the moment where you throw every pot, I think, pretty much.
Yep.
The idea being that the studio offers you completely different environments. I think the idea is that you. In fact, Stephanie said that you were working in the main space recently or a while ago. Maybe she's
not making.
Okay, she was lying to us on Saturday.
Have you moved the wheel around at all?
No, I'm not allowed to. My architect tells me exactly what it's like. Mies van der Rohe. You know, I'm not allowed to do what. We'll get to it later. But there are these two hanging spaces in the studio, which one where I make pots and one where I write. And I'm incredibly happy with those two spaces. And so, you know, this is where my wheel. And actually, it's very small. I mean, it's, you know, the mezzanine is not hugely bigger than, you know, this kind of space here. So, you know, it's a pottery studio for that, you know, for God's sake. But actually, the amount of space I actually need to actually make a pot is actually very modest. Everything else is immodest, but that's modest.
So the other cut that you just mentioned as you come back into the main studio, and this is slightly viewed from the mezzanine as well. So there's a sort of there's definitely a changing condition of light which this throws into the space of the sort of office building. Another void was cut at the other end, which would connect it back to the studio itself. So this void was cut, which now becomes another vertical space for displaying work, and again offering that connection to the writing studio. You see that in that image, this sort of blast of light that comes through. I think the other thing is about south light versus north light, which is this offers the one sort of moment of.
It's incredibly beautiful. It's an incredibly beautiful space. It's hugely successful because you've got these big white walls in the sort of main part of the studio where you can put up your vitrines and what have you. But then there's this sort of, because there's this double height thing with just flooded with light, you can put one very, very, very small object in it. And it's just you can really, really kind of concentrate on things. It's an interesting.
This is a space where you test. This is where works come into a conversation of agency, is it?
Yeah. Well, you can all kinds of things go on. But for instance, at the moment we're working on a whole palette of new glazes, and that is the place that from choice I would put those objects because I can come in the morning and not see them, and then I can elect to go and look at these things, and it gives me that kind of very fierce concentration of going and looking at something. It's a bit like a chapel. I'm not saying my work's remotely sacred at all, but there is something odd about a constricted space you come into which is then has light coming down and where you look at things. It's one of those sort of somatic kinds of conundrums. You know, you are suddenly feel differently.
And so I think that this is then shows the connection from where, I mean, I think this is slightly tidier than maybe all the time, but the writing mezzanine is, again, a very modest space. But there was something very specific you were keen on as well about the opacity of the glazing on this writing studio. So there was nothing radical done with it. The windowsills, for instance, was just painted out, but all of the glass was just... We introduced translucent glass just to take away the immediacy of that connection with the environment and allow the light to...
Well, the immediate environment outside is South Norwood bus garage. So, you know, come on, it's not like I'm missing some kind of Tuscan hill or something. I mean, there's something very interesting about you know, when you're writing that actually, you know, you go in and in. So actually, this kind of beautiful light does do something very special.
And there's a similar narrative that the library here, interestingly, it really wraps around sort of two sides. It really takes you on a journey from the entrance hall into the writing studio in a much more embedded way, I think, now that the library and writing very much forms that transition from sort of arrival and entrance through to that more considered space. And I think the last few slides are just showing the sort of flexibility about the space is equally home to your dog, which there's a space for the dog in every part of the studio. Most of the time it is full of packing crates, and you know, this work in transition and testing is that it's a very calm space to look at the work and consider it. But I was really interested recently, the sort of generosity again of using the space with other people to re-explore, because although there aren't other people making pots in the space, you opened this dialogue with Romilly to show her work, a jewellery.
A wonderful jeweller called Romilly Summery-Smith, who uses medieval Roman jewellery, which is found by metal detectors, and sort of repurposes, recreates them into contemporary jewellery. And we did an exhibition a few weeks ago where we showed her work in the studio very effectively, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was amazing just seeing that care of making something on that scale alongside the testing of the glazes, actually, because it really allowed, I think, people to reconnect or to connect with your work as well as the jewellery and this sort of fascinating work, seeing the dialogue of those two together. And is that there are still traces left in the studio, aren't there, of the...
Very expensive bricks, yes, 24-carat really gilded bricks.
So that all, and then the sort of calmness, the discreetness, I think.
You really wouldn't know. I hope you wouldn't know.
Although, Kate, you did mention on Saturday you thought the grey was a definite giveaway, something was going on.
You could feel that there was that little bit of care that had gone in. It wasn't a standard grey. And when I made this comment, I just saw the grey, because there's no... The rest of the area just doesn't have that sort of consideration. It just hasn't been aesthetically treated. I did make a comment. And how many tests of grey did you...
There were a few grey tests.
Yeah.
It really felt like that. You could feel that someone had cared about this corner. Yeah. I've just got two quick questions and then we'll go out to the audience. But there was something, Edmund, that you said when the image of the lobby came up. And I think you said something like, it works more and more and more. And I wondered whether that was as much a comment that you were finding new things in the architecture or the studio and finding new ways to do, sort of interacting with it, which is this sort of sense that architecture's...
Well, that's effective architecture, isn't it? I mean, if I'd exhausted the building, then we wouldn't be on stage together, because the capacity of a building to not only to kind of to help you look at where you think you're going, but also to surprise you is really generative of ideas. You know, it's really tremendous. So, you know, it had to be big enough to do different kinds of projects and be able to do suspended vitrines and things. All that kind of stuff we knew that was the kind of work that was going to be happening. But actually, what's one of the things that I'm finding is that it really works on a small scale as well. It really works on the kind of this scale, the hand scale, which is something I'd really hoped for, and it's actually completely happening. So the more and more is my kind of, I'm putting my hand up and saying it works.
And it was interesting how you did relate that. I think you said something also, you wanted in your studio, in that space where you were going to work, it had to be intimate. And I thought that was a really lovely word. And I just thought I'd like to ask you a little bit more about what that means to you.
You'd like to ask me about intimacy in front of me? Okay, fine, Kate. It's a very big deal for me because, you know, I'm completely evangelical about the fact that things I make can be anywhere in the world. They can be at huge scale. They can be occupy all kinds of public and complicated spaces. You know, and very contested spaces. I mean, we did a huge, complicated project in Vienna this year, which was, you know, hugely difficult, interesting thing to do in a difficult building, a difficult space. So, complicated places, yes, but there's absolute fundamental for me, which is about that they all come because I choose to sit down at my wheel and make something. So there is absolute sort of adamantine basic thing about making things which are intimate, which are fragile, which are breakable, which are have that kind of agency in the world, that sort of that human experience of being in the world, which is what making a pot does. So, you know, it can be as things can be as grand as you want. But if they haven't got that, then they're not alive. Now, actually, that had to work for me in the building. You know, I didn't want it to be grand. I wanted it to be big and beautiful and interesting and mobile and expansive. And it's done all those things. And it's also wonderful because it's not grand.
David, can you reflect on that moment of intimacy? Because it must be quite incredible to see these just beautiful objects as well. I mean, they're kind of each of them in your building, and then also that you had them in your own space. You know, what do they do for a space for you?
I think the amazing thing in the studio is the actually you appreciate the intimacy of the work more through it being, or certainly in a different way when it's in a vast context, or that you can take great distance from it. So the amazing thing through the sort of, there were huge challenges in the previous studio about being able to step back, and I remember the testing for the V&A installation, which you can, the distance that you were going to ultimately observe this piece from was deliberately as big as it could possibly be, and within the constraints of that studio, like, it was all about scale models, and models are really useful to relate the human being within a kind of volume of space, but there's nothing that can quite simulate the real distance that one can observe. So I think that the opportunity within this space was really to open a dialogue where we could enjoy the vast distances. And I think it was important we didn't close off the space in its entirety. We kept the longest vista you could possibly have so that in dialogue with that we could bring a kind of immediacy.
Yeah. Kate, you did actually mention right at the beginning, though, Kiefer. So I'm now feeling like I'm really shortchanged by my building because it's not 600 acres in the south of France or indeed an enormous kind
with
of aerodrome.
An amphitheatre.
An amphitheatre. So I think we need to start all over again.
Fine. It's OK.
On that moment, we might turn out to the audience. Are there any questions, comments, things people would like to put forward?
I was being asked whether there was a conversation about having a little lie down, but place. Actually,
this
do you
following
know?
Following your conversation about intimacy.
Do you know? I just fall asleep at my desk. I just put my head down on books on mice and porcelain, and I'm asleep.
I think Edmund doesn't sleep. Actually, I think there are times when you don't sleep, aren't there?
There are certain years I don't sleep. This year and last year and this year I haven't slept, but it's a good question. Do you know what, that would be of such a dangerous thing, because actually I do have a family and I do love my kids. It's quite nice to go home, so if it even more comfortable, then there would be a risk.
Did you have conversations about music?
Not really, but I mean, I know music's always in the background of Edmund's work. There's a rhythm of that I know informs how you work.
Yeah, and it is a fantastic space to play music in. I mean, because the acoustically it's absolutely stunning. It's absolutely stunning, particularly for the incredibly kind of tedious driving American minimalism that I go for my poor old studio. I have to put up with Reich and John Adams and Philip Glass all the time. I'm surprised they last it, of course, but. In fact, they don't actually. They wear headphones now. Come think of it, but what I do want to do, and perhaps we should do this, is to have live music. I think it'd be beautiful to have a concert in the space.
Because I imagine you'd actually really you'd feel the connections in other ways as well, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and the great joy about kind of church music is not being, for instance, is not being able to see something. You know, it's not exactly the basilica, but you know, but you could. I think we should do. We should do music. We should. That's a good thing.
That
we'll do
was
music.
A really interesting project. The Kettle's Yard exhibition, where you actually had a choral performance, didn't you, in the chapel with the work, which was really a spellbinding.
Well, increasingly, when I do projects, we do have concerts and music associated with them. So, but not in the studio. That's a very good idea.
How did you think about light? Because light is very important to your work, and you sometimes play with shadows and so on. But all I saw was these thin neon lights, which I would think would not be very inspiring or intimate or anything like that. How did you discuss that?
Well, from our point of view, the lights are the space is incredibly flexible. In fact, because the lights don't need to be on most of the time, the space relies almost largely from our point of view, in terms of natural daylight. And the most amazing thing happens is that which the sort of blast of golden light that you get coming in from the double height void actually provides this brilliant highlight to sidelight some of the pieces and. That changing quality of natural light definitely informs the space. But it is true that part of the brief was also to simulate the fact that, you know, the Gagosian needed to be able to show that you could actually put gallery lighting in the space. So the neutrality of it also was part of the condition to play both of those two things together.
It's a really good question, because I actually put my foot down about having more sophisticated lighting, because I didn't want sort of ersatz lighting. I'm much more interested in things being gloomy than things being over bright. You know, key text for me is In Praise of Shadows. You know, it's about how objects work as light fails, or light gets more interesting. It was much more important for me that actually, you know what, if you want to see it in different light, come back and look at it again. Rather than have banks and banks and banks of sort of expensive daylight things up in the roof.
But we did. I mean, we had a walk around on Saturday with various guests, and it was really enjoyable being there for just, you know, the changing weather during that time completely changed, and you went through the studio and that engagement with the changing lighting condition did mean that you saw one installation. One moment, an hour later, it just looked completely different, and I think the luminescence of the inside of the pots was really, you know, articulated.
I mean, just a moment down in Margate at Turner Contemporary, we've got an installation called Atmosphere. I don't know if we can find it. This is a good example, because we can't actually mop this up in West Norwood terribly well, those conditions. But actually, what we could do is we could suspend vitrines in the studio because of the brief. Which was fantastic. And we could work out opacities and densities of different kinds of glass. But actually, it is absolutely about waiting for light to change. You know, so this is in a strange neoclassical temple on the Ringstrasse, you know, where just during the spring and the summer, there was just a pair of my vitrines just sort of with the doors open, you know. And sometimes it's rainy and cold and Viennese, and sometimes the sun comes out. So, you know, it's just wait is the answer, I think.
I'm French, so let's try to communicate. Maybe my English is not so well, but to go back on some Kiefer talk, and also what you say about like the neutral surface. Anselm Kiefer said like he didn't need architects, I guess, for his artist studio, because he was like you, really involved about like creating in like place with history. But when I see all these images, what I can see, it's like it's really neutral spaces. Everything's white, like kind of glossy and clinic, and also massive. Like we have the table and this black stuff. When we see our work, it's more like fragile. It's like porcelain, really textured and really colorful. So my question is like, do we need this contrast between like the neutral surface and your artworks to create?
It's a very good question. So what you're raising in your question is this dialogue between frame and content, between a building and the space within it and how you place things within it. I mean, one of the things is that the vitrines which I use, the things that I frame my objects with, actually aren't clinical or neutral. They're quite tactile. They often use lead or plaster or different kinds of structure in order to provide a setting in which my fragile work can be. So they seem at first glance to be sort of to have a kind of a minimal quality, a minimalist quality to them, to have that kind of framing device. But they're not. And actually, this building, though it does use white, is actually also full of texture. It's got all the texture of the previous inhabitants, of the brick. The floor isn't a kind of off-the-shelf kind of posh poured concrete. It's got lots of movement in it and lots of colour. And there are lots of bits of the building which have been left behind, which are still there and very kind of, you know, very much in dialogue. So it isn't neutral in that sense. It's actually, it's a highly specific series of whites. And on that, I'm just finishing a huge book on the meaning of the colour white, which is why I've got to stop at that moment, otherwise I'm lost.
We'll be here till next September when it comes out.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea of imperfection, I think, which is what you're talking about, isn't it? Letting the history come through. Because it was interesting, you know, you chose this site very specifically in part because of its resonant history, didn't you? I mean, it seems to have a similar...
No, I chose it because it came available. I was desperate, and it was up the road. But then, Kate, then there was this extraordinary conversation about what, you know, what we do with it. You know, what do we keep, and what confidence can you bring to it? The things that you did were in terms of these great cuts into the building, which were very dramatic, you know, and I slightly quailed, I have to say, at the first sight of what you were suggesting, but keeping lots of other things, were very interesting, you know, decisions and emotional decisions.
I mean, we really wanted to keep more. I mean, there were linings to some of the rooms from the explosives, which were zinc-lined rooms, which were...
We could have done Kiefer. Joseph Beuys would have loved some of these zinc rooms, but you know what? Sometimes you just do things. You've got to. I didn't want it to live in a Sebald building. Actually, I didn't. I wanted to get to work.
Yeah. I mean, I think the balance of the. The imperfection and some areas of perfect background is really important, and the dialogue of being able to place the work in a rich context, albeit it's within the controlled tonal setting, but the texture does come alive and allows you to offset the work in a way that is really important in dialogue with the clean spaces. And there are we left loads of areas which were quite messy. Within the building, deliberately, so that again you can actually locate work in places you just wouldn't expect to find anything.
Is it not a challenge for you to create work which is going to be put in front of golden mirrors, on golden tables, in aristocratic houses, which you've done as well. I wonder how you feel about that.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. So that actually is, in many ways, that's a question. I did a project at Waddesdon Manor, which is a sort of, is an 1870 fake French chateau in outside London, where everything is gold. You know, you cannot move for gilding. The brief there, which I gave to myself, was to not to move anything, was to bring work in and actually not move a single thing in this extraordinary over-the-top. So of course it's a challenge, but why wouldn't you want that challenge? I mean, why wouldn't you want to, you know, I don't want my work only to exist in some a sort of antiseptic kind of loft somewhere alongside some trophy art. You know, it's much more interesting to be up against it in whatever way. And being up against it might mean being in a museum amongst lots of other stuff. It might mean being on a Louis XV table. Because actually, in all those circumstances, you can find a spatial coherence, a way of framing something and holding it just slightly apart in order for it to be in conversation with the space. So with Waddesdon, did you see Waddesdon?
Yeah. No,
yeah. Which was crazy. I mean, a crazy series of spaces. I did these floating vitrines, these vitrines which actually were on thick perspex bases. So they just, you know, there was lots of marble, but they were just floated above them.
I did not expect it to work out so well. Juxtaposition was really interesting, and you did it in a very controlled way.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that response. One of the things was about hiding work, because it's sometimes really important not to have everything immediately overt and immediately on show. Mm-hmm. And so in Waddesdon, actually, I did a series of vitrines which I kind of hid in different places, partly for my children, just to see whether they were paying attention. But partly, actually, because that is absolutely about your eye adjusting to things.
Final questions, comments we've got before we close up?
Before we have a glass of wine.
We get a glass of wine, exactly, and then we'll be able to continue the conversations. I mean, I think this work really just, it does set something alive. It sets something in architecture that's quite incredible. I'm sure you've felt this as kind of working with Edmund. Actually, what his work does to space is something that I think architects are quite enviable of.
Yeah, I think Edmund wants to be an architect. I'd like to be an architect. We'll swap jobs one day, but I don't know if I do such a good job.
Well, maybe one final question then for you, David. Have you seen, in this process of working together, have you seen your work develop? Do the conversations with Edmund sometimes echo as you're doing things, or do you find them playing out in moments?
The nicest thing for us is that we have an installation of Edmund's work in our studio, which is moved with us to our new studio as well, and it places the work in each working space. And so and theoretically we're supposed to move those pots around,
but yeah.
Again, everyone's terrified to move them because they don't want to break them, knowing the story of what happens. So I think the this idea of finding the work allows us to connect as a studio. It allows it reminds us of the sort of narrative between the work that happens through a sequence of spaces, and that's something which we try to embed in every project that we do, whether it's an urban project or an intimate project of architecture. So that narrative of conversation is something which strikes us very firmly.
Always end any conversation on the word stories.
Well, thank you for some wonderful stories tonight and for sharing them with us. Because I think it's, you know, the studio is really beautiful, and it's something, you know, I was lucky enough to spend sort of an hour and a half on Saturday, cold Saturday morning, watching the light play. And it does change, and I I think it will continue. You will continue to have a dialogue, conversations with that space. And I hope that your conversations continue and that the project on Beak Street might happen, and if not that, other ones, because I think through both of your work you open up new conversations for us and new understandings and ask us to actually take time with things. You know, we often don't stop and look, and I think that getting down to see the installation in Margate is just extraordinary, down in Tipperfield's new building, but watching these new installations come up, interventions that ask us to think and look about the spaces around us. So thank you both for sharing this with us. It's been lovely. And do join us for a drink and to continue the conversations. Please join me in thanking Edmund and David.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.